The loudest. The biggest. The brashest. New York is its own character in every play.
The bad thing about New York is the pressure. You're always under pressure.
Here are the stories about those plays. It's New York Accent with Damon Amendola.
He took one of the bats we got in like fourth grade at Yankee Stadium and like played in Little League with it. And I remember it breaking. He like sliced one and it just snapped open in like shards, and it was all like blue paint crap on the inside.
Konstantin Maroulis has already lived a life, and this guy's not even 50 years old yet. Back in 2004, right around when the Yankees blew that 3-0 lead against the Red Sox in the ALCS, sorry, bud, he became a television sensation as Konstantin from American Idol. You know, before that, he was the lead singer of a rock band. After finishing sixth place, though, in the season that crowned Carrie Underwood, his career and notoriety exploded. The guy's a New Yorker, born in Brooklyn, raised in Bergen County, New Jersey, and a hardcore Yankee fan and Giants fan who remembers the craziness of Bat Day at the old stadium in the Bronx. After Idol, he launched a solo music career, selling out shows in New York and across the East Coast, and then getting into acting with a star turn in Rock of Ages on Broadway, earning him a Tony Award nomination for Best Acting in a Male Lead. Now, he's got another huge gig on Broadway called Rock and Roll Man, which opens up later on this month, playing the lead of legendary Cleveland DJ Alan Freed, who coined the term rock and roll, brought rock and roll to the masses, and is a huge reason the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is in Cleveland. Like a great athlete who has performed and succeeded under the bright lights of New York, from the Garden State Plaza around the holidays to the forgotten role players in pinstripes, this guy's got stories. This is Konstantin Maroulis' New York accent.
Konstantin, how you doing?
Brother, what's up, man? DA, definitely a big fan. Thank you for having me.
Oh, very kind, man. Thanks so much. And look, as a sports audience here and a sports talk host myself, it is cool to see you rocking a Yankees cap as a native New Yorker. You grew up in Brooklyn, I believe, and so give me the roots on becoming a Yankee fan.
There was no choice. There was no choice for me. Definitely born in Brooklyn, born at Park Slope at Methodist Hospital a long, long time ago in a galaxy far away. And my family's mainly from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. We left Brooklyn when I was pretty young, moved to North Jersey. Predominantly grew up there in the suburbs of Upper Bergen County. For those that are familiar with the 201, a little town called Wyckoff. Then basically lived my whole adult life back in Manhattan for the last 20 years or so. And more recently, I've been raising my daughter out in the suburbs again. Got a little house in the country. So my roots with the Yanks, wow. You know, I have probably 25 or 26 first cousins on just, I think, my mother's side.
Wow.
And yeah, it's nuts. There was no choice. My cousin, Gus, who was also a Konstantin, he was a big Yankees fan. He instilled that on my brother, who's 11 years older than me. Of course, my parents grew up in Brooklyn, so they were Dodgers fans originally. But then they switched over to the Yanks and leapt out of the television at me I'm old enough to remember a little of the late 70s stuff. I mean, I'm a toddler at that point. The excitement of the late 70s teams and the Bronx Zoo and my brother loving Thurman Munson and whatnot, and the baseball cards being around, and then forget it, the 80s Yankees are just everything to me. Ricky Henderson, of course, Don Mattingly, and the boss, and just the allure of it. It was just part of who we were in the Maroulis house, for sure.
Every baby of the 70s or 80s who's a Yankee fan knows Donnie Baseball, and I feel like every single one of you guys wants Don Mattingly in Cooperstown to the Hall of Fame. I'm sure you had the 84 Tops Don Mattingly card, which became iconic, or a poster on your wall, you know, him with the machine gun. I mean, I feel like I can envision your childhood loving Donnie Baseball back in the mid 80s.
The hitman, for sure.
Yeah.
The mustache, the pushing the limits of the hair, the hair rule with a little bit of the mullet winged out in the back, and just the, you know, lazy sort of lefty stance and the great glove at first. You know, obviously he was hindered by injuries a bit there, and that shortened his career a great deal. But what a baseball player. Just an incredible hitter and seemingly a great teammate, you know. And I think it's obvious in the career he's had post his playing career as a coach, you know, his knowledge for the game and baseball IQ, just huge. But we could use him these days. I mean, I love Rizzo for sure, but you know, it would have been nice. I remember rooting for that wild card team to really get through and hopefully you know, give him a chance to get a ring, but it didn't happen. You know, they had, man, it's funny when we look back, if that wild card existed in the 80s, I think all those teams the Yankees would have had that would have been in the playoffs. And yeah, they didn't have the pitching because the boss kind of traded them away, but they had a closer at one point. That was great. Had some good journeyman sort of relievers. But, you know, when you have Winfield, Henderson, Mattingly, then Jack Clark, and, you know, Pagliarulo, and some really good role players, they would have had a shot. You know, that would have been pretty cool.
Number one, you're spot on. We had a lot of second-place Mets and Yankees teams throughout the 80s. If the wild card existed, it would have been interesting. Second of all, now I know you're a real New York or a Yankee fan when you cite Mike Pagliarulo. If you can do a Pags reference, then you have cleared the hurdle of super fandom around these parts. So you've earned the blue check mark around here. You know, it's amazing because if you turn back the clock to when you went to American Idol, when you're being introduced by Ryan Seacrest for the first time, he cites the fact that you're in a rock band that could be kind of described as like Black Sabbath-like. And I think about a guy that was in a rock band that might have been a Black Sabbath type of band spinning forward to becoming a Broadway star. That's a pretty wide range you're able to click off right there. Could you have imagined this type of path when you were in the middle of rock and roll?
Well, you know, it's funny. I always idolized my brother. He did a little of everything growing up, from acting and writing and performing in different rock bands and later sort of underground electronic type bands and such. And I was always influenced by so many different music styles. I always grew up with musical theater since I was very young. We used to watch West Side Story together as a family. My mother would point out the Greeks she knew from Brooklyn in the original film with Natalie Wood. And those are the few real strong memories I have of the five of us, my brother and sister and I, my parents, being together, because they're much older than me and my brother and sister. So it always was very real to me, the musical theater thing and the acting. And conversely, I always just was good with a microphone standing in front of the band. It wasn't like one of those theater kids that like thought he could sing in a band. Like, it really kind of came naturally. I gravitated towards classic rock and the great front people like Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, you know, obviously the Beatles and the Stones and the great Woodstock era of music. I loved the Grateful Dead. I was a big Deadhead. I got into the early days of Fish and all of that. So I just always had, and I loved books and theater and literature and stuff. So and clearly sports I was obsessed with. So just kind of all over the place with that. And I think for me, it's really ultimately about like storytelling. And I think my band at that point in the late 90s, yeah, we were sort of doing this kind of grunge meets, you know, Limp Bizkit type of thing or Incubus type of thing. And it probably didn't even flex all of the things that I could do, but that was the sound of the band that I was in when I auditioned for Idol. I also had just been in Rent, touring around the world for 2 years with Rent. So I was like, theater boy, and then I'm a dark rocker. So I think that the Idol stuff, it was just good TV. And I think Seacrest and the producers kind of were like, all right, the Brooklyn thing is cool right now. Remember, it's almost 20 years ago. Yeah. And I think that was a bit of a hook for them to kind of be like, who's this guy? We've never had anything like this. So something like that.
Did you ever feel out of place in either one of those two worlds? If you're a rocker in a Broadway world, or if you're an actor, a thespian in a rock and roll world?
Yeah, that's a great question, and thank you. Yes, I think that's natural. I think you sort of become synonymous for these bodies of work along the way. You know, I was known to be in Rent for a while, then it was the Idol thing, and then it was Rock of Ages, and it's like, okay, can you do anything else? It's like, yeah, I can do Shakespeare, I can do Tom Stoppard, I could do a film. It's good to be known as like Constantine from Idol and all of that, but also it can affect people viewing you in a more neutral way, and they sort of typecast you, which is a good thing as well. You know, at least people consider you for something, but you can definitely be typecast. And for sure, I think some people along the way are like, he's not really an actor, he's not really a rock singer. And then they work with me, and then they're like, oh, okay, he really can do both. You know, later I got to do Jekyll and Hyde on Broadway, a revival of the 90s Frank Wildhorn production, an all reimagined version of it. So in a way, I really got to do, you know, I was living that Jekyll and Hyde life where I had like the theater boy thing. And then I sang in chorus as a kid, and in high school I competed in competitions, but then I was playing, you know, in the city as a teenager in rock bands, like trying to get signed. And I was trying to do both for sure. And I think all those experiences add up, and it's great life experience. Playing sports as well. I mean, I loved playing sports, but I was never going to be good enough to play at any next level. But I think like the camaraderie, you know, all the sort of cliches you learn in sports, they really apply in my work on stage as well. You know, right now I never leave the stage in this new show, but I'm nothing in this show without like an incredible supporting cast. And when I do teach like young kids and work with them, young performers, I'm like, it's hard to be Derek Jeter. No one gets to be Derek Jeter. It's a once in a million thing. Be Brett Gardner. Be somebody that has longevity, that can play a long time, that is relied upon, that is a leader, that, you know, can sit and then go into the game and play different positions and, you know, stuff like that. So there's a lot of sort of parallels with my work and sports.
And I think that goes for a lot of places in life. I know when I mentor, hand out advice for young broadcasters, I oftentimes say the same thing. You'll go really far in this business if you've got a great attitude, you're easy to work with, you support others, and you're willing to do anything. Those are all controllables. You know, you might not have the best talent, but if the boss or producers or other people know that you're dependable, good to work with, flexible, and you'll give it your all, and there's always a role for you. So my guess is those are tenants that work in entertainment and a lot of the projects that you've probably accomplished as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, it's clear with your work and how you've, you know, always adapted to whatever the situation is, whether you're jumping in there, you know, subbing in on the big shows or doing whichever. And, you know, it's not easy to do, and I recognize that. And the people that know, we know. But no, I think what you've done is wonderful in the scene. And you know, I grew up on New York sports radio. It's funny, everyone's like, "What do you listen to in the car?" I'm like, "Sports. That's all I listen to." And you know, talk. We grew up with the AM radio on in the house all the time, in the kitchen. It was always on. Bob Grant in the 80s, my folks would listen to. It would be on in the kitchen. It would be on in my father's garage. Bob Grant, for those that don't know, was like the pioneer sort of talk show host on the radio. He could be on every day and talk for 6 hours about anything. And he sort of fancied himself as this moderate guy, but he did say some wild shit over the years. And but I'll never forget, and even Howard Stern recognizes him as a huge influence. I mean, the guy could go on all day long, take phone calls. No one ever did anything like that live on the air. And then they basically copied him in every market. Like later with Mike and the Mad Dog, they copied that in every market in the country. So I think, yeah, in this business, you have to pivot. You have to be good at a lot of stuff. It's nice to be great at a couple of things, but I'd rather be just really pretty solid at a bunch of stuff. And I like it that way. I think after Idol, you know, I had amazing opportunities. I think if I focused on one thing, just one little thing, like I wanted to have a hit song or something like that, I could have definitely just accomplished that. But I had so many things come my way, like from television to acting and Broadway and writing and, you know, touring and producing. And later I had a family, and I hear congratulations is due to you. You guys had a baby recently, didn't you?
We did. Thanks so much for saying that. Yeah, last week we had our first little baby boy, AJ Amendo, came into this world last Tuesday. So now I'm in your zip code, and it's a mind-blowing experience. It's beautiful in a million different ways, but it's a total out-of-body experience. I often look at AJ and say, "Is that really mine? Is that really my child? Because this feels like I'm playing a role, like I'm Mr. Mom. I'm playing some dad in a 1980s movie."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Michael Keaton. Be knocking on the door in his apron any day now. Yeah. Isn't it funny how the instincts just kick in? Obviously, our partners and whatnot are of great help in the family around us, if we're lucky to have that, or friends. But, you know, as dads and such, it just kind of kicks in. You know, it's not stuff you thought about or planned, at least not for me. I didn't read all the books. I didn't, I was touring like so much. I was not prepared, but I just was ready when it happened. And she came into my world, and, you know, we're very close, and I can't believe she's already 12 years old, 12 and a half. She'll be 13 Christmas Eve. So we've got a little time left, but it goes fast, man. It goes real fast.
I could only imagine. How do you handle a Christmas Eve birthday? You want to make sure you honor the birthday, but you also obviously have to deliver Christmas.
Oh, man, it's not easy, because she's really like the only child like in my family. You know, my brother and sister are very successful, have great partners, whatnot, or spouses, and they just don't have children. So, and my father passed 10 years ago, and, you know, it's just my mom out there. And, you know, so we all are so hyper-focused on Milena, and her mom's family mainly lives on the West Coast. So she just gets like smothered. How we handle it mainly is, you know, of course the kids are home from school at that point, right? They the latest you'll break from school is like maybe the 20th, 21st or 22nd or something. So we have to have like an early December birthday party. So it's one of those things. So she gets the early birthday party, then she's got the birthday, which she gets more stuff, and then Christmas Eve, both with me, then her mom, and, you know, we co-parent. So it's she does pretty well. She does pretty well.
She cleans up. That's good to know. That's always important. My guess is also on Christmas Eve, on her birthday, you're not allowed to go anywhere near the Garden State Plaza, because that is a snarl. At the corner of 17 and 4, you don't want to be anywhere near there in the month of December.
I grew up there because my mother worked at the Macy's for like 30 years.
Oh, you know, wow.
As soon as we moved to New Jersey, she got a gig at the Macy's, and she was running the place by the time she left, and I grew up there. I mean, they would, you know, in the summer, sometimes me and my best friend, my neighbor, obviously we were psychotic for baseball cards in the 80s and all that, she would bring us to work, and we would hang out at the mall all day, but we would just like hang out at the baseball card kiosk, like trading and buying and opening packs and doing all the stuff that the kids are totally crazy for again then. So I grew up at the Garden State Plaza, now called Westfield or whatever it is.
That's right.
But, you know, I'm not a point and click kind of purchase person. I still go to the mall. I like going to the mall. You know, I love clothes and all that stuff. I'll go like super high end, but then I'll mix it with like a lot of Marshalls, a lot of Macy's, a lot of deals. Nice. My mother would wait till something was like marked down to like 80% off and then drop her 20% on it. And they're like, it's free. It's it. Actually, we owe you $10. You know, like she would wait it out and she had it down. So I really grew up with like the whole, you know, Macy's culture for sure.
As a baseball card fanatic of the 80s and early 90s, I assume that you collected a few Greg Jeffries rookie cards and Ken Griffey Jr. rookie cards, which paid the down payment on your house, right? You probably actually had your first house already paid for through the riches of those two cards.
Well, of course, we all thought that Greg Jeffries was going to be. And I remember being upset. I'm like, how did the Mets have this guy, you know? And but it just didn't work out for him or Kevin Moss. Did it? Kevin Moss, didn't. I got pages of Moss. Forget I got pages like this. And the right Griffies are valuable. The right Griffies are nice. It was fun. I you know, we all know what happened over the shutdowns. We all went through our stuff and we're like watching The Last Dance. You know, of course, the great Michael Jordan series that ESPN did, and was amazing. And we started going through our old stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, I got all these Jordans. I got all these rookies. I got this. I got that. I'm rich. And this is like, this is cool. No one's acting. There's no Broadway. There's no music. There's no touring. But I got baseball cards. I'm buying up more shit. Like, I don't even know what I was doing. But it was so fun. I got to be honest. It brought, like, I had a girlfriend at the time. I was like, I'm busy tonight. It was like,
I'm busy with a set of 1987 wax packs. I'm sure you understand.
I got plans. I got stuff to do. I got organizing. I got to do a lot of, I'm shuffling. I'm putting things in penny cases, then in hard cases.
I've got a lot of Matt Noakes and Kevin Seitzers. I've got to go through these.
I got to go through so many of these. There's so much of that stuff. The Billy Ripken FU card.
Oh yeah, you had to have it.
You know, and of course the Menendez brothers on the
basketball
card. On the Mark Jackson.
Mark Jackson, yeah.
They're sitting front row, the Menendez brothers, like, they like wasted their parents that night, probably. It's crazy. The culture is insane. You know, it's funny, I never gravitated towards the Knicks or the Nets so much. Mm. I fifth, sixth grade, a rich neighbor took us to Brendan Byrne Arena to see the Nets play. We sat, like, courtside. And Michael Jordan, it was probably his rookie year. Wow. And we were just like, oh my God, bouncing around. He was like Spider-Man out there. And forget it, we bought the hats, we bought the jerseys, we bought everything. And that was just Bulls. And this is like when he had nobody. This is like, you know, this is like the Charles Oakley and Jordan, and before Phil Jackson, certainly before before Scotty and Horace Grant and everybody, but those early Jordan years. And, you know, he was like this mythical character because they weren't on television every day, you know? So you had to like look up the TV guide, like when are they going to be on TNT or one of these,
yeah,
or watch the Ahmad Rashad Saturday morning show to get a glimpse of him. And I was just drawn to it. So I became this psycho Bulls fan from like basically 86 to like 2000. And all my friends hated me for it. They thought I was the biggest Fairweather fan, and I was. I don't care. This is my team. And I don't know, you know, I love the NBA. I love basketball. I played basketball in high school and such. And I love supporting my high school in Franklin Lakes. They were great. They won the whole state tournament this year. Nate Burleson's kids play on the team. So,
wow.
Yeah. In your sort of CBS, world.
Yeah.
They transferred over and, they're really good players. His oldest son is going to go play at his alma mater football, at Reno, I believe, in University of Nevada. Anyway, so we love to like go back to that. Everyone's like, you're like this like rock star. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm like a soccer dad living in Wyckoff. That's what I am. And I like to come when I'm around. I like to come and watch the football games and watch basketball. And I just, yeah, I just never gravitated toward the Knicks and the Nets a little bit, like a little bit. You know, I root for them. It was just, and I don't think the NBA ever really recovered after, at least after Kobe. LeBron, I get it. Once LeBron, the decision, it just kind of killed it for me. I love Giannis, of course, as a Greek. I claim Giannis, you know, but it's the game. It's just not the same for me, you know.
If I called you a Greek freak, would you take that as a compliment?
Well, oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay, let's get back.
Definitely.
You're bringing back good memories for me because my first time to go to an NBA game, I was in Boy Scouts. And in the late 80s when we went, they definitely were not going to take us to a Knicks game because it was way too expensive. So they took us to Brendan Byrne to go see the Bucks when they were horrible and the Nets when they were horrible. And all I could remember is that we were some of the only ones on the upper deck at Brendan Byrne for that game because they brought my Boy Scout shirt.
So that, yeah, Boy Scouts definitely was a free ticket. Definitely yeah. saw some horrible Yankee teams on a Boy Scout. Cub Scout. I never made it to Boy Scouts. I made it through Cub Scouts. And we definitely went to some old Yankee Stadium games with them sitting in the freaking like rafters. Bad day, psychotic. Like, can you imagine them giving 20,000-30,000 bats out now? That would never happen.
Never. I was there for bat day once at Yankee Stadium. Even though I grew up a Mets fan, my buddies in fifth grade were Yankee fans. So we went there and I got this little mini bat. And I remember thinking to myself, this is awesome that everybody in the stadium has one of these like little weapons in their hands.
Yeah, we had the full-size blue ones. And I remember this kid, Doug Snow.
Oh, full-size? Wow.
They were like, you know, they were probably 28.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, maybe 30s. Doug Stokes, he was like this incredible basketball player. This kind of kid that was like 6'5 in like fifth grade. And he and his brother, both brothers, like dominated high school basketball and went on to play in college. And he took one of the bats we got in like fourth grade at Yankee Stadium and like played in Little League with it. And I remember it breaking. He like sliced one and it just snapped open in like shards. And it was all like blue paint crap on the inside. It was just. Hardcore,
that's like the Wyckoff version of the natural. Instead of the lights exploding, it's the actual bat itself that splinters into blue dust. This is an opposite field single.
Yeah, from the left side. He was a lefty, I remember. So, definitely not conducive for optimal barrel percentage, barrel rates. But those were the good days, you know, for sure. And just always love the sports, you know, always, you know, that it's like sometimes that sense memory as an actor talks about, you like pick up your old glove and you smell the glove and you're like, you know, it's just, you're right back to like where you were so many times on the field, you know, picking daisies in the outfield or, striking out, you know, at the wrong time or maybe getting the clutch hit and, just those great feelings for sure. And my kid plays sports, which is great. It's not for everybody, but for me, it was just a huge part of my life. And I stay away from like the dad sports nowadays because first of all, these dads, they're like crazy. And okay. I don't need any part of like fights or like a knee injury, you know.
Or abusing umps, abusing refs. Yeah, you got to stay out of that game.
The worst. I do enjoy a crazy video online or two. Like, you know, Twitter has just changed so much, whatever. But like, I seem to just stumble into these like fight videos, you know, parents like going nuts and like just brawling over like a volleyball match or something like horrible. It's like, what is wrong with you? Yeah, that is not good.
I like the fact that you have a real appreciation for radio and for the sounds that come out of the box, because I feel the same way, which must make playing Alan Freed in Rock and Roll Man specifically very pointed and powerful for you. For those that don't know, Freed was a real revolutionary, a pioneer as a DJ, bringing a mass audience to music that was primarily an African-American side of music to a larger audience. And so for you to play that role, it must be really powerful for you since you love that side of radio creation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a dream role to play for me. You know, this is the stuff we long for, to create a great character like this. Certainly, you know, he had a great legacy. He was a flawed man, and sort of forgotten in the sort of, you know, the story of rock and roll. But there is no story to tell without the contributions of Alan Freed. He believed in the artists. He became friendly with them and close to them and wanted to elevate them and really laid his life on the line. He was a severe alcoholic and a flawed guy that was gone way too soon. He was dead by 43 years old.
Wow. And
they came after him. They made him an example. He didn't play ball. He got caught up in scandals. You know, we sort of get to tell we get to tell all sides of the story. We celebrate the great era, the incredible music, the incredible artistry of the early 50s. Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Laverne Baker, all the great, you know, quintet and quartet acts like the Coasters and the Moonglows, the Drifters, Bo Diddley. But we have this original score that's woven in that's very unique to this sort of like catalog musical. It's not usually both. It's not usually the case where you have these great songs, you know, all the ones you know, Shaboom, you know, Life Could Be a Dream. You know, you have Great Balls of Fire and Tutti Frutti and, you know, all the amazing tunes, Jim Dandy and such. But you have this original score that is reminiscent of the era that helps sort of tie the whole thing together. Because Alan Freed was not a singer. He was not an artist. The whole show is set. Basically, we meet him on his deathbed. He's alone and penniless in Palm Springs, you know, out of a job, out of the game by 43 years old. And he's longing to get back. And it all sort of takes place in this fever dream of his, where he's on trial, like, for his legacy. And they came after him because he elevated Black artists. And at a time when really, it was just not cool. I mean, to think that our country was, you know, at a place not even a lifetime ago where we were segregated, even in big cities like New York, it's surreal. It's surreal. Yeah, to grab the mic and to do these IDs or to talk up a song in this, I learned so much. You know, I've done some radio along the way. I worked at WABC for some time and a lot with the digital sources and all. And it's been great, man. It's been great to jump into what you guys do. And, you know, I've become friends with a lot of the guys on The Fan, you know, Craigie and all of them. So I've learned so much from all of them, really. And I definitely use all that. And I definitely apply all of that into the work, for sure.
So before I let you go, just give us the context of this era for rock and roll music, because today it's kind of impossible to imagine deciding on what music is played based on the race of the artist. That just doesn't apply anymore. That's just not the currency anymore. But in the early 50s, it was. So that's the backdrop of Rock and Roll Man. So describe that for us.
Yeah, it's totally surreal to think that Little Richard wrote all these amazing songs and, you know, they were only essentially marketed to, you know, an underground audience. And in areas where they would only play on the radio, where, you know, African-American communities could hear, and then popular white artists would cover the songs and they would become humongous hits. Mm-hmm. You know, Pat Boone sold millions of records of Tutti Frutti doing this corny version of it. And Little Richard was, didn't receive a penny for that. So we talk about that. We talk about, all of those exploitations and, you know, we celebrate the great moments, but we also really lean into the drama. And, you know, it's a celebration of music, but it's a heavy piece, man. We're dealing with an era that was unkind to so many of our friends and their families and communities. This is a picture of Alan Freed So if you, I really quite transformed myself in the show head to toe. And our great director, Randy, he knows I like knickknacks and collectibles and stuff. He's always bringing me stuff. He got me a Salem, Ohio, 1941 yearbook.
Wow.
Alan Freed's high school yearbook from Ohio, where it all started for him. You know, Cleveland, Ohio, the Record Rendezvous. He was also persecuted because he was Jewish. You know, this is post-World War II. So it's like, you can't be both Jewish and play black artists. This is a big no. And he said, you know what? F you, I'm doing it. And it became so big, they couldn't stop him. And, you know, that's when like J. Edgar Hoover and the government came after him, the Klan, everybody. And, you know, he kept it rolling. He was doing movies and TV. He came to New York, WABC. He was doing tours with, for the first time, desegregated audiences, black kids, white kids, you know, black artists, white artists on stage at the same time. He was doing movies with all of the above. This is before Dick Clark. This is before Elvis. He created the phrase rock and roll and he popularized it. Now, he's no savior of like, you know, white savior or anything like that. He was a flawed guy. And I think that's what makes it really interesting in our show.
So tickets are now available. This is going to premiere on June 21st. It is going to be in New York City.
New World Stages, where I began Rock of Ages 15 summers ago.
Oh, wow.
Before it became the global like hit and iconic title that it has ever since. So we're opening right in the heart of Broadway, right at West 50th and 8th Avenue, right here at New World Stages, June 21st. We start previews shortly, just for a couple of weeks. And then, yeah, definitely the plan is to run all summer into the fall through the end of the year and then transfer to like a big old theater, you know, but
awesome.
We'll see, you know, we're excited. We have a great cast, Joey Pants, who's not here yet. We actually share the dressing room, who you would know from The Sopranos, from The Matrix, from The Goonies, from Risky Business, just an iconic film actor. He plays a great part in the show, actually two great parts. So Rock and Roll ManTheMusical.com, RockandRollManTheMusical.com. Great tickets available. And definitely hope to see you at the show. I think it's an awesome summer piece. And, you know, the city, as you know, it's safe. It's beautiful. Walking around has been wonderful. And there's nothing like, you know, the sun shining and you're walking into the theater and that old smell of the place. It's good stuff, man, for sure.
One of the best nights that I could ever dream of is going to the city on a summer night, seeing a Broadway show, going out to dinner and drinks afterwards around the theater district and just soaking all of that up. I just love it. I find it amazing. RockandRollManTheMusical.com is a website for all the information. As Constantine just described, it's a really cool storyline that they are bringing to life on Broadway. So check it out. It opens up on June the 21st. Constantine, if I ever get a full night's sleep here, I'm coming out to the theater to see this summer, okay? So I appreciate so much that you took out the time as you're from your dressing room getting ready for all these rehearsals and everything, man. It means the world that you took time out for us.
DA, no, please. It's my pleasure. And congratulations to you and your family. And, you know, we'll be here. So maybe the Yanks will have a little playoff run and maybe we'll see you in the fall up at the stadium too. And then my Giants, forget about it. The league is on notice, okay? My Giants.
Forget about it. Yeah, you're really doing Jersey.
My Giants are coming for everybody. Just watch. I've been day one, Daniel Jones, number one guy. So that's my guy. And we're excited about, you know, all that is Big Blue as well.
See, it goes Giannis, Mike Paliarulo, and then Daniel Jones for Constantine.
Right? Yeah. Oh, I love throwing an obscure Yankee in there. Wayne Collison.
Oh, you know, nice.
Butch Weiniger.
Oh, look at that. I did not expect to hear Butch Weiniger today. Very nice. Very nice. This is awesome, brother. Thanks so much for doing it with us.
Thanks, Damon. Appreciate you having me.
Many thanks to Constantine Maroulis for joining us here on New York Accent. Boy, that guy's just got so many experiences and so many cool stories. And What a huge swing of a career to be able to be a rock and roll singer, then to be a Broadway actor, to have performed for American Idol and then gone on tour with a musical career, to be so good at acting, to earn a Tony Award nomination. I mean, the guy's done it all. And I loved, as you could tell, I love that he loves the Yankees so much. There's the role player that he feels so passionate about. When he drops a Mike Paliarulo, I'm like, dude, now I know that you're in the club. Now I know that you care about the guys that many have never heard of or forgot very quickly. So a Pags reference on New York accent is very welcomed around here. So thanks to Konstantin Maroulis for joining us on the show. You know, I mentioned on last week's podcast, I'm a new dad, and so our little AJ is about 2 weeks old now. And I found myself, as I pulled the overnight shift for feeding and diaper duties, as daddy night care, I suppose, figuring out what I'm going to watch at night as I kind of keep myself awake. And so I ended up watching the Mets Hall of Fame speeches from the weekend, where Gary Cohen, Howie Rose, and Howard Johnson and Al Leiter all got into the Mets Hall of Fame. And you want to talk about a degenerate old school Mets fan in the middle of the night moment here. So how do you keep yourself awake at 3 a.m. after the bottle is fed and you're trying to burp them and just make sure that everything is okay? You watch about 45 minutes of speeches, every single one of them. You don't fast forward through any of them. And let me tell you, I loved Gary Cohen's. I love them all, but I loved Gary Cohen's when he said, "I'm one of you," just a kid from Queens, sitting in the upper deck at Shea. I thought that really resonated. And I thought Al Leiter was outstanding, that Al was so enthusiastic. And I guess I didn't realize that his whole family had grown up Mets fans. And so he was great as well. And I love Howie and I love Hojo. So that was really fun to watch. But after watching that and after watching Howard Johnson get in, it reminded me that the guy was a 30-30 guy three different times, 87, 89, 91, three different 30-30 seasons for Hojo. And I said, you know, let me see if those old Mets video yearbooks that they run on SNY, especially during rain delays, if those are on YouTube. And I popped over to YouTube, and sure enough, there was. And so I spent the night watching late 80s, early 90s Mets video yearbooks. That's right. Yeah, that was my night after the Hall of Fame speeches. And I particularly enjoyed the 1988 and 1990 video yearbooks. And look, this is going to sound really pathetic, like I'm totally stuck in the past, but that 88 team, I remember so fondly, and the loss of the Dodgers was just so heartbreaking in the NLCS. But that's a really fascinating team with Hernandez and Carter on their last breaths as members of the Mets. And the team started to go through the transition where they brought in Kevin McReynolds because they worried about Kevin Mitchell or the clubhouse or bad boys doing bad things or what have you. And McReynolds had a really good season that year, finished third of the National League MVP voting, but was never truly a Met. Nobody ever really embraced him. To then the 90 team that was left for dead and then went on a crazy run to try to catch the Pirates and nearly did, sweeping them at Shea late in the season only to fade down the stretch. And that was the Buddy Harrelson season where they fired Davey Johnson. And speaking of Paliarulo and some of the Yankees players that you just heard Konstantin mention, brought me back to how much I love Dave Magadan. Magadan exploded in 1990 when Mike Marshall, I guess, had friction with Davey Johnson. Marshall was brought in to be the first baseman after Hernandez, short-lived. Magadan takes over and just explodes. And Magadan's hitting RBIs at Wrigley Field as a 6 RBI day. He kind of explodes onto the scene. He hits throughout the entire summer, and that kind of launched his career. And it made me remember a guy that maybe is not going to be remembered by many and is never going to be in the Mets Hall of Fame and have a speech like that one day, but who was such a great natural hitter and just a good guy and a good teammate and just fit in so well. And I remember how much I loved a young Dave Magadan and used to pretend to be him playing wiffle ball, doing his stance. Just that natural swing that Magadan had. I just remembered, boy, yeah, I love that guy. I love that guy. So maybe we can get him here on the New York Accent podcast at some point in time. But this is how you spend your nights when you're just trying to kill time and stay awake and make sure the baby is fed and diapers changed and he's burped properly. So there's two of us burping in the middle of the night now. Okay, that'll do it for this episode of New York Accent. Thanks to executive producer Bryce Gelman on the project as always. You can catch me weekday mornings on CBS Sports Radio as the morning show on the network side of things. That's on Sirius XM channel 158 or streamed to the free Odyssey app. You can also catch me weekends on WFAN. And this podcast is available all places that you get your podcasts. So subscribe, rate, and review. That helps other people find it if you do leave a review. And you can always watch the podcasts on YouTube. They're available on the WFAN YouTube channel. Until next Tuesday, have a great rest of your week, everybody. This is New York Accent, an original Odyssey series.